Yes, apocalyptic conditions and coding are. That laptop never really worked the same way ever again. So hey everyone, I'm Dan. I've been very nicely introduced, so I won't repeat what's just been said. I would like to say how much I appreciate Adam bringing me back to Lisa. I haven't been to Lisa since like 2005 or so, when I was still living in Seattle, and my badge actually still says "Welcome back from Seattle." Like, I really like, so I'm a security researcher. I really like actually getting these opportunities to speak to non-security audiences. For about the last year, and only publicly in the last few weeks, I've been working on a startup called WhiteOps.com. WhiteOps is dealing with what turns out to be the primary reason why machines get broken into and merged into botnets. As it happens, grandma's email, not that interesting. What you do is you actually pop a million systems, click a million ads, get million-dollar checks. It's depressingly easy. You rob a bank, people get annoyed. When you rob advertisers, like, ooh, our numbers went up. I don't tell you this to show off or advertise my startup. I tell you this so you understand there's a reason I got the Unix beard going on. I've actually had to build something, which if you spend much time around security is not a thing that we always do. Sometimes we just poke at your stuff and be like, what are you doing? Why would anyone do it like that? Turns out there's an answer. So the biggest thing that I learned working on WhiteOps was the difference between hacking and engineering is constraints. When you're hacking something, you don't give a crap. You're like, nothing is limiting me. I don't care what the side effects are going to be. I want this system to do something and nothing's getting in my way. That's hacking. Engineering is basically, I am limited by a thousand different things. The best thing in the world is for me to find out what's limiting me before I hit it smack in my face. I'm going to prevent all of these problems. I'm going to adjust all these constraints. I'm going to modify this system, understanding how it works, so that it does whatever the heck that I want. You still get what you want. It's a little harder. It involves having to know a heck of a lot more things. So that's kind of the difference. And it brings up a really interesting question of what does it look like when we make stopping hacking, when we make security an actual engineering requirement? Because I promise you, it did not used to be. You hear about these systems from like the 80s where everything was super secure and separated. No. Ultimately, security may have been modeled, but as an actual thing that you did to stop bad guys, it was an ignored field. This ignorance had consequences. And a lot of people said, if only we did X, if only we did Y, everything would be secure. And then the bad guys showed up in force in the early 2000s, and everyone who had been saying, if only we did X, people were like, okay, maybe we should actually try X now. But, you know, it wasn't engineered in. It was hacked in. We just tried stuff. This had consequences, too. You'd be amazed how many people have said, I mean, I was actually at dinner the other night. Someone's like, I always used to say, why don't they just turn on SSL? I've spent the last 2 years working on just turning on SSL. It turns out, though security is an engineering requirement, it's not the only one. You still have performance and reliability, you have debuggability, you have usability. You break these things, you don't ship. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a Zen question here. If you write a fix and nobody deploys it, does it help anyone? Now that Zen is an answer. The answer is no. You have wasted a lot of your own effort, maybe the effort of the people who listened to you, but you didn't actually protect grandma. If you want to do engineering and not just hacking, security cannot be your only engineering constraint. But this does not mean we can't whine, because, oh, we're so great at whining. Here's the reality. When you're hacked, and you're running any system of any sort of scale, you are hacked, it's your fault. It's always your fault. They'll always find some way to make it your fault. And it's a horrible experience, I promise you. There was a recent study basically said getting compromised is worse than getting a divorce. At least there's an end. At least you know who you're up against. Strongest predictor for any product, whether it takes security seriously, is whether they've had compromise in the past. I'd walk into a room with teams as a security consultant, and I could tell in seconds, have they walked that road? They have this faraway look in their eye. It is literally shell shock. It is literally PTSD. I am not joking. I will make many jokes in this talk, but I promise you, this is a horrifying experience to anyone involved. And the worst part of it is, you're blamed. There is a human universal, and it is ugly. The human universal is as follows. If there is a violator of norms, if someone does something bad and they cannot be punished, then what everyone else does is figure out some excuse to blame the person who got hit, because they don't want to believe it could happen to them too. Here's the reason why it happened to them and not me. If you can't punish the assailant, you punish the victim. It happens in all societies, in all sorts of situations. This rule appears as strong as hungry people riot. Now, you would think, in any rational world, we would respond to this horrible pain, and it is horrible, by finally going ahead and doing the right engineering things to deliver security. Well, let me tell you, as someone who's been doing this for 15 years, we do not actually know how to deliver security at scale. Let me repeat, we really do not actually know. It's not that we're lazy. It's not that we're not spending money. I've watched incredible amounts of money get spent on things that everyone knew would make no difference. But we still tried it, because we had to try something. We don't know how to deliver security at scale, but I think we're sure as heck going to find out. So the nature of the cybersecurity crisis, what's going on here? We have three problems at the same time. First, we don't know how to authenticate. We also don't know how to write secure code. We really don't know how to bust the bad guys. Now, when I say we don't know how to, I don't mean it is physically impossible. I mean there's a budget of this and a requirement list that is infinite, and even when we try to buy it all, it doesn't work. We can do these things occasionally, but not well enough. If we had one of these problems, we'd have a crisis. We have all three at the same time. That's the fundamental formulation of our engineering challenge. This is what we got to go fix. So if we're going to do things differently in 2014, and I think we are, and I think I'm seeing a lot of things that are finally very different now than any other years that I've been working on this problem, we have to do this with no religion. This isn't like SQL versus NoSQL, where, you know, like, at least we have databases that work. No, we're really failing. We in security have failed you in system administration. This has happened. And the only ones who are going to get us past this failure are going to be the ones that are not attached to the religion of how you build secure systems. Because we all know it doesn't actually work. We're going to need new science. That means we're going to need new data. We're going to need new instrumentation. But let me tell you something. We've changed the way that we build our networks out. Every other engineering requirement has also had to get new data and new instrumentation. The reason why is because continuous deployment has won. Okay? The old model was waterfall. You'd build your thing, and then you were done building, and now you test your thing. You were done testing, and sometimes you might find something so bad in test, you go back to building some more. But there's always more time. It'll come out some year. And then you deploy it. And if there's an issue, Because, you know, you always find some things when it goes out in the field. You have to patch out of band, and it's a big deal. That is not reality anymore. Everything is continuous. We are simultaneously building and testing and hacking and deploying and failing left and right. Independent of security, this is how the world works now. And the only way we're surviving deploying like this is we have grown our operational knowledge and experience 100-fold. We are not doing things the same way. The big point of software as a service is we're not letting this code go out there because no customer's going to figure it out fast enough, and we have to update that thing. So we'll run it in-house. That is actually what's going on here. And in-house, what are the things we're doing? We're actually looking at our logs. We're actually searching them. We have a Google for our internal search. It's called Splunk. We're doing A/B testing. We're live, not deploying the same thing to different customers. Usability had to adapt. Performance had to adapt. Reliability had to adapt through active management of the data that we were getting, both collecting more and changing what we were doing in real time. Why not do this with security? Is security somehow married to the waterfall model? It better not be, because otherwise it's getting kicked out the door. There's a fundamental weakness of waterfall security. Is anyone here good at chess puzzles? Anyone? Like, I'm not. I'm lost. But I tell you, if you stick me in a room for a month and say you'll give me $1 million if I figure out where to stick that queen, I'm going to get it. Because I have an infinite amount of time and I have an incentive. Puzzles look like they'll be hard, but they're only hard to the right kind of opponent. They're not hard enough. What we need are games. You stick me in a room for a month with Garry Kasparov and say, go beat him at chess, I'm going to lose for a month. I'm going to lose for a year. I'm going to lose until I die. And it probably doesn't need to be Garry Kasparov. Games are a lot harder than puzzles. Continuous deployment. It's about adaptation. We can ship faster, we can ship better, we can ship cheaper. To survive this, we have to monitor, we have to report, we have to adapt in real time to our mistakes. We have to make the attacker do that too. Continuous deployment means that our systems have stopped being puzzles that we ship out and wait till they die, and they start being games that adapt to circumstances. In continuous deployment, there's no such thing as an out-of-band patch. You know you're shipping it buggy. It's okay. You'll fix it. Guess what? When it comes to security, whether or not you realize you're shipping it buggy, I promise you, you're shipping it buggy. So there is a signal that every attacker emits that is different than your actual operations. You know your network. They have to discover it in real time. They have to go around. They have to see what's available to them. You have your logs and they don't. You have a concept of normal on your network that you're watching anyway, or your continuous deployment would be failing right now and you wouldn't be in this room. They don't have that. They have the average of all possible customers and all possible victims that they've seen in the past. So you have an advantage. You have a thing that you can go for. And in fact, this is not a prevention advantage. It's very rarely going to help you stop them from breaking in the first place. It is very often going to help you detect where and how they're in and possibly prevent you from getting access any further. NetWitness has been an incredibly successful product line. The reason why is because while there are many ways to break in, possibly an infinite number, the number of things you can do to discover your surrounding network is actually a limited set when you don't have briefing in advance. It's much easier to get caught. So that's the game. The game, as opposed to the puzzle, is giving your attacker a cost of making errors. They see a thing and they think, that's what I'm looking for, but I might get busted. I might get caught. Even when they might be right about their assumptions, they're never sure. They need to be in a state where even if they're right, they think there are consequences if they are wrong. And that's how you go ahead and actually start actively defending. Waterfall models just make for harder puzzles. Continuous deployment allows you to make a game, and you are under no obligation to make a fair game. This isn't, you know, it's your network. You get to cheat. I'm just telling you, making sure you realize there aren't many times in security you have a defender's advantage. I'm telling you, this is where it is. Use the crap out of it. So what does it look like? What am I concretely telling you to do? I love analogies, but there's always someone in the audience who's like, if he gives me one more analogy, I'm going to take this chair and throw it at him. So as it happens, look at this error here. Text may be a little too small. Basically says uncaught database exception. You have an error in your SQL syntax. Check the manual that corresponds to your MySQL server version. What's going on here? Where did this error come from? Well, what it means is at some point, a database call that was well understood, where the syntax was correctly turned into a parse tree, at some point, a different understanding happened. It wasn't an exploit, or it wouldn't have errored. There is a myth. The myth is that every vulnerability will automatically be discovered, and when it's discovered, it will instantly be used to do maximum damage to your networks. This, my friends, is not true. My bug took 25 years to get found, or at least to get fixed. When there is a flaw, first someone has to find it. Then you have to go ahead and use that flaw to figure out what you could potentially download. Then you have to actually execute the download. This does not happen all at once. This is a series of signals that can actually be caught before getting to the final stage and can certainly be caught after. The SQL error is, again, somebody has found a new way to speak to our database. Now, if you're doing continuous deployment, you can know, has anyone been updating this line of code that's been causing this error? See, you've got to think like this because you got to think, how do I eliminate the false positives? When you're building systems like this, you get to screw up this many times before your entire ops team ignores you. So if you go ahead and you have someone who deploys some new code, and now there's a bunch of SQL errors, and that code actually got modified recently, it's okay. It's not someone found a new thing. It's your dev screwed up. It's fine. It happens. Welcome to continuous deployment. You go ahead and fix it, and life is good. This is work has actually been done by Zane Lackey over at Etsy. Used to work with him back on a Microsoft job. Dude is doing incredible work. I don't know if he's already given his talk here. If he has, go find it. If he hasn't, go see it. But he's actually been doing this incredible amount of work realizing, wait, we have logs that directly correspond to compromise. Just so you don't think that this is a one-time event, the anomalies that I'm talking about, you don't even need to do new logging. They're already happening. This was one thing from PHP, where PHP popped an error and said, hey, you know, unknown modifier C at this location. This was an actual thing that was actually in production at Etsy. Zane takes a look at it and goes, C? If that's E, that's arbitrary code execution on all of our servers. These logs are not just things to be ignored. They're signals to be mined. The larger lesson, relevant prediction really, is that there are three ways to look at a program. You can look at the source code, or you can compile it, look at the binary. Why do you do this? Because source lies to you. Never really know what the compiler is going to do, especially with C++. Like, the number of things that can happen to change where that final function goes is insane. So a lot of people just say, forget it, I'm not even going to care about what the source says. I'm going to look at the binary. Sometimes you look at it at runtime. You look at the code when it is actually running, actually interacting with the system. Why? Because a binary lies. The binary is like, oh, I'm going to grab this library, and here's how I think it behaves. Wrong. It's a lie. Oh, yeah, the garbage collector is totally going to take care of this. Nope. I don't think the only bigger lie in engineering than garbage collection is autoscaling. The game is to seriously start linking log entries to attacks that are beginning to succeed. It's not helpful to know how many people are trying to hack your network. There are 7 billion people on this planet, and a lot of them are assholes. You do want to know, however, which ones of them are actually getting through and actually doing things. And there you're looking for the rare errors that are correlated, that are not correlated, excuse me, to actual changes in your network and changes on your systems. You know what they are. You have to if you're surviving deployment. So when you're finding things changing all of a sudden and nothing that you did changed, it's something from the outside world. The phone calls coming from outside the house. There's a corollary to this prediction, which is that we're going to find more interesting things to capture. We're actually going to start directly changing our systems to attract these sorts of rare errors. I think for a decade, everyone has been predicting the spread of what we call honeypots. These are resources that have no legitimate use on your network, but if you're doing real-time discovery, they look pretty cool. They look like the big password database. They look like a bunch of tables containing PII. They look like the kind of things that PCI says never to do. They're bait. Anything touches them, you know it's not you, because none of you would be stupid enough to do that. You know it's someone is wandering around your network. There are some really nice things about honeypots. They create a family of logs that is much smaller. You have some basic background radiation, but really anything that's operating against them is a strong map to shields up. You're getting hit, and here's where the bad guy is. There was a scan that I did many years ago, though, where there was a server that was actually having a certificate called honeypot.company.com. Don't do that. There are some issues. The fact that you're not actually using the thing in production means you don't get the sort of outside analysis, like the there's sometimes just random noise that will trigger bugs that have security implications. There won't be random noise coming to your honeypots. So you do get somewhat of a degraded signal. There will be false positives from the very rare times where there's operational real-time discovery. We call that debugging. It's not a thing you get to just ban. So you do have to have a process where when you discover activity on your honeypot, you don't automatically like shut systems down and go completely crazy. It's a SEV1 thing to automatically look into, but there will be times where it's like, no, I was just nmapping the network because of XYZ. And I get to do that. That will happen in any large organization. There is a big thing now for honeypots that makes them a lot more viable, which is it's just not that big a deal to deploy hardware and software anymore. We've gotten really good at it by now, okay? We have virtual machines, we have bare metal, we have all of these ways, because in order to do anything now, we have to be able to do it at scale. We can requisition these resources. We have resources to spare. That wasn't necessarily the case before. Before, maybe we had to go ahead and really reserve room, and it was a big process. If you're doing continuous deployment, it can't be a big process. You can actually use spare resources, which you have to have for one reason or another, as your honeypots. You can take it down if you need it back. So this is nice. It does create the risk of an obvious tell for the attacker. Make sure the machines that you're setting up for your honeypot don't look like they're not actually being used. They need to still be integrated into your monitoring systems. They need to have the right ports up. They need to have some kind of load on them. Don't over-optimize yourself into giving your attackers a clean map of your network. Realize, though, you're owned. There's not a person in this room who's managing a network that has zero compromised hosts. We don't talk much about how universal the ownership is, but it's not good. You're getting played. I'm just telling you how to play back and telling you not to play fair. I do want to also warn you, your control planes are not actually immune to compromise, right? It's the standard split. Sometimes you hit the protocol itself, the way the networks are being managed. Sometimes you use credentials that you picked up one place and then speak the protocols natively. Sometimes you just pop someone's browser and they happen to be administrating the control plane. And they happen to be shared across networks, although, you know, policy says that can never happen. Policy. Systems that are easy to deploy and manage are also easy to misdeploy and to remanage. There's no going back. Like, we are not going back to the friction of information technology before we got all these really nifty ways to deploy without horrid amounts of pain. But you know, those things that caused friction for us also caused friction for the bad guys, and that friction's going away. I do want to explain why all these systems are hard to build. And my answer, I'm sorry that the text is too small for you guys. I at least download the slides. I call it goop. There is so much goop in servers. Managing goop is hard. Things like IPMI, things that manage the bare metal, they are touching the goopiest part of the PC. The motherboard is where we stick all the crap that we can't figure out how to make play nice with each other. So we put all of the special kids in the same room, and that's the motherboard. So when you need to go ahead and remotely control all this special crap, which was really designed to never be controlled by anything else, it's a headache. And so you end up with a second computer in your computer. Turns out the biggest lie of your computer is that it's just one computer. This is my iPhone 5. Anyone know how many ARM chips are in this computer? There's seven. There's seven ARM chips in here. This thing's a network. This thing's a bigger, you know? I put an entire computer network in my pocket. It's a network of machines that trust each other and all can compromise each other, but it's still a network. Things aren't any better in the software layer either. We have these hypervisors. Go ahead. You try to have multiple virtual machines not able to mess with each other. Here is the problem you have as a hypervisor manufacturer. You have a kernel that expects to be talking to hardware. These interfaces are goop. They're complicated. They're messy. They all need to do the right thing or it doesn't work. So, you got a choice. You can either emulate all the things that the real hardware was supposed to do. And this is possible, but it requires understanding all of these various messages that you might legitimately receive. Or you pass everything through down to the hardware and hope that it can do it without screwing up. Now here's the problem. There is actually no such thing as a hardware bug. This is not a thing that exists. Driver bugs, yeah, they exist. If you have a piece of hardware that literally erupts into flames if you poke it more than 10 times a second, that is not a hardware bug. The driver is specified not to do it more than 10 times a second because the hardware is done, okay? That thing is taped out. We can't go back. We got to do a software fix. That's fast, okay? Now, this works remarkably well as long as you've got a trusted kernel. But the whole point of the hypervisor is you don't have a trusted kernel. The kernel, which is the thing that hosts the driver, which is the thing that talks to the hardware, that kernel is in bad guy land. And so what do you do? The answer is things catch fire. That's kind of the bottom line. So why am I talking about this now? We got a black market. We got a black market that's on fire like it's never been. You know, I love the internet, but it's kind of solved the problem that black markets have had for thousands of years, which is, can you trust the person you're dealing with? Dude's a criminal. He's not exactly the most trustworthy person ever. And if you know him too well, then so do the authorities, and he gets busted. Okay, so the internet's fixed that little problem. What that means is that reputations and payments have become a thing that are very easy for the black market. And that means that crimeware, dedicated software to allow others to commit crime, has pretty much matured as a field. So there's a lot of people who want your data. And not all of them have any freaking clue how to hack systems, but they do know how to pay some guy for some sweet batch of code. And so a lot of attacks, a lot of exploits are moving to these black markets for pretty high paydays. And at the same time, a lot of attacks are staying out of the public sector. Security dogma is getting dated because we as White Hats, we as defenders, we can only respond to what we see, and we're seeing less and less every day. If we're to be scientists, I have the ego to call myself a chief scientist. If you are not integrating accurate data, you are not actually doing science. You are just repeating and recycling dogma. There's been a lot of denial about what's going on out there. Who here has heard about this bad BIOS thing that's been going around? Who here thinks it's science fiction and none of that is at all possible? Good. Every single bit of bad BIOS is not only feasible, it's totally happening. It's been happening for years. We know because we reverse it, and sometimes we do it. We just don't talk about it. Your computer has places to hide stuff all over the place, and all of that stuff has been explored. The guy who went ahead, Dragos Ryu, we've known him for, I've known him personally for about 12, 13 years. He's absolutely a great target to hack because we send him all of our research so we can go speak at his conferences. So, if you're going to hit someone, he's not a bad guy to hit. Everything about this, from getting into the hardware to being cross-platform, okay, the ultrasonics got a little, you're not going to own a machine with sound. You could use sound as a transfer medium for command and control, but why? You're already in. That's a little much. The only question with bad BIOS, because we're going to find like hacked BIOS and hacked hardware. It literally is the siren call that yields the result it predicts. The only question is whether he actually did or did not get hit. And frankly, it doesn't matter. That's kind of my take on this. Look, like, deep stuff is happening. Not deep stuff is theoretical. We know it's theoretical. Deep stuff is actually happening out there. When you hear about agencies finally throwing away their entire computer base because it's cheaper than wondering if you actually eliminated the malware, that means somebody got some interesting data. Hate to say it, the conspiracy theorists have had a better predictive track record than the pundits. That includes me. So a big thing that I see that we're going to have to address going forward into 2014, we're really slow. It took 25 years from implementation to repair to get my DNS bug fixed. Note I didn't say discovery. I am absolutely positive I was not the first person to find that DNS bug. I am positive I was the last. We have to move faster. If we're actually going to protect users, months and years need to become days to weeks. We can't just have this stuff floating around waiting for random people to pick it up and decide to do something good or do something terrible with it. So I don't know if you just heard, but Facebook and Microsoft have just come out with what they call the Internet Bug Bounties. When there's software that is globally deployed that a lot of our users are using, someone comes forward with the problem, Facebook and Microsoft are going to hand them cash. The economics have not always been there for the most popular software that our users depend on. And you know what? These guys are stepping forward to do something about that, and that is revolutionary. I didn't always think this way. I didn't always think bug bounties would be a good thing. I want to explain why I'm so positive on them. What we don't talk about in bug reporting is that it's not just that it takes people years to find simple bugs. It's that most, external bug reports suck. I could be more diplomatic about this, but man, you've never seen it. It's not good. It's the worst thing ever. Most external finds are extremely low quality. You'd fire someone who brought them to you. Even the ones that are high quality come from someone who has so little context into the system that they're breaking. They've imagined this entire architecture, which is based in no code whatsoever. It turns out hacking is the one field where having no idea what you're talking about can actually be a competitive advantage. You're actually not deluded by, you know, knowledge of some component is supposed to block that. The wrong way to think about things is to think that external bug finders are bad. The right way to think about this is to say, how can we invest in making external bug finds richer? And the answer may very well be, how about we make the bug finders richer? How about we actually financially incentivize them, because this is what's in our ultimate interest? Look, attackers don't care who wrote the code. They just care about who they get to hack if they hack it. Defenders need to have that exact sort of freedom. Defenders need to be able to say, I don't care that it's an open source product, or a proprietary product, or a product that came out 6 months ago, or a product that came out 12 years ago. Defenders need to be able to say, this is popular, this many users are exposed, I'm going to protect this many users. That's what these bug bounties that don't care about who wrote it, that's what we get to actually have. External finders are proven to find different families of bugs. Look, everyone knows you have to separate dev and test. They have to be different orgs. They have to have different reporting chains. If they don't, test gets rolled over. Having fully external bug finders means you get even more of the independent perspective. It does lead to just quantitatively and qualitatively different bugs. Better bounties mean it's actually worth investing in cooperation and communication. It means, as an external finder, getting on those boring phone calls, working with the dev, talking to them. That isn't necessarily a thing that has to happen for the bounties. But no one's getting a bounty for even a great bug that someone needs to spend 60 hours isolating and reviewing and wondering if it's good or bad. Because this is what you have to do. When you get these external reports, sometimes they're in really terrible shape. There might be something in there. Might's not enough for a good bounty, and that's great. You know what else is great? We need cover for not paying on bad bugs, because there's a lot of them. There's a lot of people who are going to submit crap and be like, where's my $10,000? And there needs to be somebody who's not the vendor who says, your bug is crap and nobody should pay for it. I love the fact that they're saying this is awesome and you should pay, we're going to pay a lot. I'm way happier that there's going to be judges, not who can give sixes, but who can give like negative 83 billions. Can't even tell you how many bugs reduced down to, if I had root, I could totally get root. I'm proud of you. You haven't hacked anything. There is a specific amount of interest in the Internet Bug Bounty Program around sandboxes. And this is actually what I am most excited about, because here, right here, is where there is the largest differential between what you guys think and what we know. There are a ridiculous number of sandbox escapes. Knowing how to get around an environment when you already have x86 code execution, that is not a field that is a solved problem by any means. And there is simply not much data about these sandbox escapes. This is where I think, like, we know that there have been ways of hacking PHP and Ruby and this and that, but people think it's like an exception for sandboxes. Okay, if If sandboxes were a solved problem, Google Native Client would have come out years ago. They really want it. Intel really wants it. But getting native code execution is a rough, rough problem. It is basically you have to know all the interfaces that the operating system exposes, and it turns out no one ever catches them all. You're basically in the cloud trap writ small into a single machine. You either emulate or pass through, and both ways lead to ownage. We might actually have a way to make a secure sandbox. Not everything that executes code is going to execute arbitrary code. Somewhere between adding 1 plus 1 and PHP is an interpreter that can have its execution constrained. Note, I didn't say predicted, but you'll at least know here is a finite amount of things that this can do. You might say, but Dan, you're talking about restricting a Turing-complete environment, and doesn't academic theory say that you can't constrain a Turing-complete environment? Turing-complete environments require an infinite amount of storage and an infinite amount of computation. Your computer does not have either. You're not actually exposing a full Turing-complete environment. This little gap is the theoretical gap that I think ultimately we'll get a decent sandbox out of. And where I think I'm seeing one is in a little thing. Who here has heard of ASM.js? This is an incredibly cool project. The idea is as follows. There is one sandbox that has actually been attacked for every single day for the last 10 years. And that's the thing that prevents, when you go to Yahoo from reading your Google email. That's the JavaScript sandbox. Now, that's not to say that it hasn't had its own security issues. Just like Java, every time it touches something in native code, something can go wrong. DOM manipulation happens, poof. Or some native object type, poof. But the actual JavaScript engine tends to be remarkably solid when it's not calling out to anything else. And especially if you go ahead and you remove all that external access, which, by the way, is pretty much the environment that a web worker has in a web browser, you actually have a really constrained environment. Now make it even more constrained. Make it so the only thing that it really does is move memory around and copy and do processing on integers and a little bit of other types, but only very, very basic stuff. I don't even think there's strings in there. I think it's just like ints and floats and copies. Now you have an environment that is incredibly simplified, can already be speed optimized because we've been making JavaScript fast for 10 years, can be made even faster. The ASM.js guys have gotten code execution performance on C and C++ and whatever else you can compile with LLVM. They've gotten performance to within 50% of native. Now, that may sound awful, but there's a lot of languages you're writing in that run a heck of a lot slower than 50% of native. What if we can actually get that fast and still have an actual working sandbox environment? So I'm actually making a pretty strong prediction. The thing that I'm going to do, I'm going to take libtiff. TIFF is an image format that wants to die. Like, I'm serious. You can look at a format and be like, oh, man, this thing's going to blow. It's got like 83 length fields. I don't know how I'm supposed to do that pointer. Like, no, seriously, it's not. File formats predict their own handling, you know, security levels. I think if I take libtiff and shove it inside of ASM.js, I'm going to get acceptable performance. And when I fuzz libtiff, it's still going to break. But I don't think any of those breaks are going to be exploitable at all. And I can't say the same with native client or any of the any VMware hypervisor. This approach that I'm talking about, I call it fuzz marking, is where you go ahead and you actually take random noise, you fuzz something, you see what you get, you see what you get in the same target in different environments. When I ran this on Office, I saw a 94% reduction in vulnerabilities from Office 2001 to 2010. It's actually really cool, like just watching it fall off a cliff. and then doing synchronized exploits against OpenOffice and seeing a similar, if lesser, curve. I think when I do this against ASMJS, I'm going to get good results. I also think that I'm going to get such good results that we're going to see this sort of simplified VM approach done against the Java virtual machine and maybe against the Microsoft CLR. The reason we're getting out of the sandbox trap is because we're exposing a simpler environment to the code that the attacker controls, but the environment is specially computed so that after it passes through the simplification, the machine has enough context to go make it fast again, to use the locally trusted fast libraries. I think this can actually work. Maybe. A more generic prediction for the internet bug bounty is that we're going to see a lot of new, very useful data at a rate we just haven't seen before. No more free bugs that take years to decades to find? Okay, I am down with that. I think that is good and useful. We are buying and investing in data that we absolutely need. So thank you to Facebook and Microsoft. And if you are considering whether there should be a bug bounty for your company, 3 years ago, I would have said no, and today I say absolutely yes. We want to incentivize responsible behavior. Everybody wins. So I wish I could end on this completely positive and happy note, but I don't get to just ignore this whole NSA thing if I'm going to talk about 2014. I'm not here to recapitulate Bruce's talk or to give you the big activist perspective. I think whatever your perspective on it, you've heard that. Let me tell you what I'm worried about, because what I'm worried about may be substantially different from what you've heard. I'm worried about people's reactions to this NSA stuff. As I was not willing to put into a slide, two stupids do not make a smart. Let's talk about what I'm worried about. I am worried that we are going to see the systems that we interact with start competing on political FUD rather than technical merit. Has anyone actually already experienced this? By the way, from like salespeople? Yeah. Like, I'm really worried we're gonna get, sure, you know, you could go with that competitor. Yeah, they, you know, they're cheaper and faster and nicer and more powerful, but, you know, ooga booga nation state. Like, this is a thing I really think is going to happen. And in fact, this is the one that I've directly heard. Sure, you know, BGP does say you should route your traffic through, you know, this part of Europe, because it's cheaper, faster, nicer, or network neutral, or whatnot. But if you do that, the Americans are going to get copies of all that, and the law says you're not allowed to do that, so you're just going to have to go with us. And, oh, I'm so sorry, we just don't have a peering relationship like that, so you can pay for us for all that traffic through the nodes, because we are now in a rentier position. You know, people forget. Where did I become a graybeard? Jeebus. No, seriously, I look in the mirror today, I'm like, yeah, got my Unix beard. Oh, yeah, it's sort of white. You know, the internet is not the first time we tried to do this large-scale internetworking. This is like the eighth or ninth attempt, okay? This is the first one that worked at large scale. You know why we won and the rest of the things failed miserably? Because the rest of the things tried to make a crap ton of money at each hop. They tried to be gatekeepers. They tried to be rentiers. They tried to make rules that said, if you're going to make a bunch of money, we want to cut. And we nerds didn't care. We're like, you got packets? I'll get them over there, no problem. I don't care what's inside of those. This is the network made by nerds, not by biz dudes, certainly not by politicians. This is the network that works pretty well that we have to defend. Not to put too fine a point on it, but we sure as heck did not want the Chinese internet 6 months ago. I don't think we want it now. I understand and am sympathetic to the people who are saying we don't want our data to traffic over, you know, foreign lines and go to foreign networks. That is a discussion that needs to be had. But the ugliness, but the game, the thing that keeps us having this internet is keeping political influence of any sort away from the actual engineering work we have to do. And I'm really worried that our response to this NSA actions and behaviors is to say, maybe we should listen to the politicians. That's not going to lead to what we've had, to this economic miracle. I can't say it any better. It gets worse. Guys, there's a reason we were asking the NSA for advice about cryptography. It's because at the end of the day, most cryptographic functionality does not need the NSA's help to be a disaster. It can do it just fine on its own. It takes us years, decades to come up with functions that we feel familiar with. Someone's saying, oh, you know, the NSA has a complete real-time break of RC4. You know who doesn't have a complete real-time break of RC4? The academic community, us. We don't have that. We went to these guys because we know how hard it is to do this stuff. And we really wanted the best mathematical minds in the world to give us an honest opinion. No, I work in defense, okay? We don't have nearly as much support as you'd think. Like, it'd be really nice if we had this, like, governmental department dedicated to defensive operations, like a Department of Defense. If we had, like, a conference dedicated to defense, a DEF CON. It's hard out there. This did not make things better, okay? This is one of the fundamental basics of our economy. And really, we hoped there was a line that could be drawn, and it appears to have been wildly crossed. And now we get this situation where NIST comes back with some really legitimate advice. They say, KESAC, SHA-3 is not fast enough. We need to do a little bit of tweaking on it. You know who else says that? Zuko, creator of Tahoe LAFS. It is the best distributed file system you can get right now. It's from least authority. And he says, you know what? SHA-3, KESAC, is actually too slow. We need to do something about it. He says, well, we should abandon it entirely and go to Blake. This is a discussion. Like, we need to have better performance. Like, community. Now, community response is, NIST is doing more evil. They're going to hamstring SHA-3. Yeah, SHA-3 is not going to get deployed because it's too slow. And it's too slow and fixable. We're in this weird situation. We may be replacing NIST with some guy. I like Dan Bernstein. I really like Dan Bernstein. I've been saying that we need to do a heck of a lot more with Curve 25519. But fewer trusted resources at a time where we have a fundamental threat to the economic stability of the world is not what I was looking for, okay? You know, there's a classic quote about Linux. Linux scales. Linus does not scale. We have a larger issue. Okay, guys, it's not like cryptography worked 6 months ago when we were confident that all these ciphers were safe. It was still broken. It was still screwed. The hard problems in cryptography have nothing to do with ciphers and hash functions and zero-knowledge proofs. They're not even in side channels. They're in key management and the stuff that actually deals with users. Cryptography keeps seeing itself as there's the math part and there's like code implementation. And it never sees the third part. It never sees what you in this room deal with every day, which is the complexity of operations. Operations is the hard part, okay? My first law of operations is how many meetings do I have to go to get this thing done? Have you ever seen a meeting count in an equation for complexity in big O notation? This is the thing that is missing. Your work effort is being kept out of the work. So this is where the problems are. This is why usability is so hard. Because your usability, your user's usability, everyone's usability is factored out as a no-op. And as it happens, it's not a no-op. It's the point. In this environment where we don't have a lot of trust in the systems that have actually done very, very large deployments at scale. DoD runs the largest network in the world, certainly the largest PKI in the world. That a lot of this stuff can't be, is difficult to trust. This is a very bad thing happening at a very bad time. I make no predictions about whether we'll get past that in 2014. So, to make a few conclusions, security has not gotten less messy. It's still a disaster zone. But I think continuous deployment, the improvements that it's done to the rest of our engineering requirements are going to make a big difference for security in 2014. This is when the conversations are going to happen. Detect real-time discovery on your network. Deploy the honeypots. Use your newfound flexibility to make a game that you cheat shamelessly at. Bug bounties, they are the new reality, and that's okay. We are going to be spending a lot of money on people who are going to tell us what we're doing wrong. And we're going to be able to expect a higher degree of credibility and communication from this audience. It's going to be a little strange, but hey, we got users to protect, and we're all in this together. Figuring out how to sandbox code, figuring out how to take the broken code that we're all writing and put it into an environment where it can't burn us is going to be a thing that we are going to get some answers about in 2014. We are actually going to get sandboxing working in some way. It's a stretch goal because let me tell you, I've been cynical about this in the past because a lot of the stuff really doesn't work. But a good friend of mine once said I was being defeatist and I didn't listen to him and he was right and I was wrong. I think we are going to be able to figure out how to do unsafe things safer. The NSA stuff is not going to go away. It's not going to blow over. This is a fundamental change in the way that engineering looks at government interaction. I don't know exactly where this is going to go. It's going to be a lot of politics. There's going to be a lot of FUD. We're going to have to really push back on the types of sales operations that try to get us to ignore engineering realities and try to ooga-booga us into buying. There have been some critical resources that have been compromised. A lot of the standards that we built our systems on are going to get reevaluated. I don't think all the standards were corrupted. I don't know how many were. I think the best possible case is to be able to be an open accounting for us to say, these are the ones we hurt, and the rest actually we did not break. There are some real problems in cryptography. There are problems where your work effort and your user's work effort is given no value, short thrift, and that's why it's broken. When we figure out finally how to fix cryptography, you're going to have a seat in the room. And that's what I've got to say, and I'm open for questions. Go ahead.
Are you concerned at all that bug bounties and things like this, as they pick up prevalence, are going to just kind of reframe the incentive of bug disclosure such that if the thing that's motivating me is I'll make X dollars for this quality of bug, maybe I'd rather take that bug and sell it on the black market rather than on the open public market because I can get more money for it over there?
You know, not everyone wants to be a drug dealer. I don't know what to say. I know a lot of people who just stopped finding bugs rather than go down that route because you're putting yourself at risk. You have a family. I have a specific case and specific person in mind who's like, I was offered $100,000 for this vulnerability, and I had to walk away and take nothing because I have a family. So I think that the bug bounties do not have to be at the full scale of the, I think the bug bounties have to not be at the full scale of the black market, but they should reflect the value that they're bringing to protecting the foundations of the economy. Where I get more concerned is when bug bounties get paid for crappy bugs. Because then you have a situation where the bad money drives out the good. That's the thing I'm afraid of, and that's the thing that I'm really excited has been dealt with in this particular situation. Any other questions? Whoa! I did not fall on my face, I'll have you know.
Yeah, on, this is Rick Farrow. On bug bounties, there was a nice paper researching Google and Mozilla, who actually had a bug bounty program much longer than Microsoft.
Yep.
And what they found is that it was actually economically beneficial to them because the amount of money they were paying for people, external people finding bugs, mm-hmm. was less than it cost them to hire an extra engineer to do it, that they weren't getting a lot of crap. You know, most of the stuff they were getting reasonable, so it worked pretty well.
Yep.
That's more of a comment.
The experience with bug bounties has been very interesting. I mean, this has not been a sudden shift. Two companies, ZDI and iDefense, were both paying bug bounties on a scale of hundreds to low thousands. And that turned out to be somewhat okay and somewhat not enough. Google and
Mozilla.
It's
okay.
Google and Mozilla went ahead and started doing this, and Facebook as well. And the experience very much has been, over time, the quality has increased. Look, the game is just making sure that... So first of all, external finders just find a different population of bugs. You want to make sure that they're finding useful bugs. You want to make sure they're finding real bugs. You want there to be knowledge at the reception point of how to deal with it. It's not 2002 or 2003 anymore. We're not the first engineer ever who's shown up at a company and said, you've got a security bug. Someone has come before us. Usually they're an idiot, but at this point, external bug finding is normal. And so now the question is, how do we make it more professional? And the money seems to have really helped. When you're getting a stream of high-quality bugs, it trains you as an organization what low-quality bugs look like. You're a lot more confident about what to reject. So it didn't have to work out that way, but that seems to be what has happened. This is not the... You know, those of us who thought, and I consider myself one of them, those of us who thought that bug bounties were just going to lead to chaos, no, they've led to responsible behavior from people who are making money doing good work.
So I have a second question.
Go ahead, go.
Looks like you're a Windows 8 user.
Mm-hmm.
And
love my Surface.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to Caesar. And he said something that perked my attention. He said that the programming model within Windows has always been one where you don't have the typical isolation that you have in the Unix model. And this is done for performance reasons and ease of programming. So that if you want to make an ROP exploit, it's actually easier because you have access to just about everything. Could you, am I understanding that correctly? Can you explain that?
Oh, you're understanding what he said correctly, but none of it's true.
Okay. Well, yeah, I know Caesar, so you have to take a lot of what he says.
Pseudo make me a sandwich.
Grain of salt.
So here's the situation. We're all using single-user machines. We really are. In Unix, every time we want to do something scary, we type sudo in front of it, and we pretend that this has done some magic thing to keep us safe. You have an attack. I was in college when I was complaining about sudo, okay? Like, sudo you can defeat with a bash command called alias. In order to use these actual single-user machines, who here shares their laptop? Anyone? How's those multi-user machines treating you? We're all doing single-user machines.
Well, actually, anybody who I visit a website and run their JS, I'm sharing my computer with them.
Yeah, well, totally different layer, though.
Yeah, okay.
This was the thing I was going to talk about in the slides.
Okay.
We have our machines and our operating systems aligned around the concept of there being users that the kernel switches between. And this is not actually how we use our computers. And when we write software that has users, it's not the layer that we're going ahead and building users into our systems. Has anyone here ever seen not for intranets, but for external systems, have you ever seen having like Unix accounts for your like website user? No, you never do that, because that would be ridiculous and horrifyingly insecure, especially if it was a Windows environment, because now you're giving people outside your organization internal credentials. Mm-hmm. You get no real effective security from the present situation, whether it's the Windows model where there's all these objects that are ultimately system objects that you get interfaces to through handles, or whether it's the Unix model where you type sudo all the time and the attacker just hooks sudo. It's all the same crap. Like, the reality is, if I actually have to say what's harder to exploit, Windows has a much deeper model for address space randomization, for data execution protection, for heap hardening. It is a much harder proposition to actually get your exploit to work on Windows than it is Linux. There are distributions where this is not entirely true, such as GRSec. But let me tell you, like, no one ever looked at UAC, the constant prompting in Windows as a security feature. Certainly no one should ever be looking at sudo as a security feature. Anything that can be busted with a bash alias is a security feature.
Okay, thanks.
So you proposed making security more about games than puzzles. And I was wondering if you had any good examples of either in the abstract types of games that work well as security games, or concretely implementations of that sort of thing.
The concrete way you make security a game is you find a way to allow the bad guy to lose. Bad guy loses when he's detected. So you're playing stealth games, Assassin's Creed, you don't want the guards to find you. The game is to give the attacker a bunch of paths to follow, some portion of which are going to get them detected. The game is to find things that the attacker is going to be tempted by that don't happen in normal operation and get alarms on those things. The game is lying. The game is not. So this is one thing that we've learned from White Ops, from our advertising work. Don't tell the attacker immediately that you caught them. Don't give them the immediate feedback so that they know, oh, next time I better not do that. If you have a finite number of tricks, you want those tricks to last as long as you can. So don't. There's a balancing point, because you also want to tell other people how to find bad guys, so they find the bad guys too. So there are some complexities there, but real-time feedback to an attacker for what they've done to get discovered is rarely a good thing. Does that answer your question?
Have you seen good implementations?
Have I seen good implementations? Talk to Zane Lackey over at Etsy. His is profoundly good. Everything that I talked about in this space has been from watching what they're doing there. There are certain log entries that when they show up, bugs are auto-filed. It doesn't even go into an alert queue. It's just like, wait a second, we got that kind of error? Why are we getting this new kind of error here? Someone needs to look at this on like the 24/7 cycle. So the real key is, the real key in making that work is false positive management. I know it sounds like an abstract thing, but like really, you get to screw up a finite number of times. So there are error classes like the new part. So any A parser takes a string of bytes and turns it into a tree. You have a finite number of trees that you're generally using in production. Like, even when you're dynamically creating SQL statements, generally the trees stay constant. One of the things that we're working on is basically alerting to say, a new type of tree has formed. Is this okay? And sometimes it's going to be. Often it isn't. And I'd love to say the solution is, aha, we should fire every, you know, there's this thing for database programmers where they're told if you don't do a parameterized query, you're going to get fired. We're going to fire you. Okay? This is a sign of failure. When else do you ever see in anywhere in management, we're going to fire you? Like, this is not a normal way human beings communicate. We laugh about this here. It's because parameterized queries are so painful and terrible to write that no one actually likes doing it. And they avoid it whenever they can. And we don't admit it. We celebrate the painfulness of writing code. I don't know, because it like makes us, you know, better or smarter. And so a lot of the work that's coming is going to be in figuring out how do we get the security properties we want while giving developers the style of coding that they clearly need.
I just bought a new ThinkPad, and one of the zillion features that I was trying to research on it that it was asking me to go sign up with, one of them was called Intel's Anti-Theft Protection, which once I read up on it, it sounds a lot like that bad BIOS thing you spoke about earlier. Allegedly, it's in the firmware, and it can sneak back into Windows if you remove it and so forth.
Yep.
So it sure sounds real to me.
Oh, of course it's real. No. I mean, like, but my favorite thing was the guy who was like, this couldn't possibly be true because in the BIOS you can only run, you know, 802.86 real mode emulation. It's like, dude, you have ACPI. The kernel comes to you after it's booted up in full mode. It's like, hey, got any code for me to execute? Like, this is, you know, this is well known since John Heisman did a talk on this in 2007. So, you know, nothing in bad BIOS isn't happening, except maybe the ultrasonics. Go ahead.
So, Dan, next year, the XP becomes end of life on April 8th, and there's a fair amount of companies spending considerable resources preparing for that, et cetera, with the expectation that April 9th, there's a whole bunch of release of 0 days, et cetera. So since you're making predictions about 2014 and you're discussing snake oil salesmanship and internet bug bounties, I'm wondering if you're looking at that kind of event as a sort of like a lunar eclipse and temporary distortion of bug bounties, et cetera. I wonder if you think about that.
My biggest concerns about XP entirely revolve around the browsers cutting off support. The browsers are the interfaces to the world. The browsers actually cut things off, I get really worried. Because they're the things that are executing the arbitrary code. I think the real question is whether XP support will actually be cut off. And I lean against it actually happening, but I don't know. I do know that there's Chinese companies that do nothing but turn your pirated Windows machine into a fully patched Microsoft blessed system. So I know that XP is not going away. It may, I don't know. I think they're raising the temperature and just really trying to get more and more of their major customers onto a more supportable platform. But I don't think support's going to go to zero. In fact, that much I'll predict. Support will not go to zero. There will be some amount of cash you can throw at Microsoft to continue getting support. Just a question of when it's going to become too expensive for you. Next question.
So Dan, on the topic of sandboxes, I was wondering about your thoughts on projects such as Capsicum, which with the OS integration.
I've just never seen. I believe at the point that you are asking the x86 processor to accept your instructions, it is actually game over. That is my actual thing. If you've ever read Intel Errata, like those chips were not designed to deal with a malicious kernel. They're barely designed to deal with a malicious user space. I mean, barely. This is just not a thing that hardware vendors do. I'm sorry, I love Intel. They're a performance company. They're not a security company. No one in hardware is a security company. So that's why I'm pretty down. And I mean, I'm saying this knowing how many people are sitting on hardware escapes. And there was an errata in one of the Intel chips. You could throw microcode into the CPU from a guest. The instructions still worked. Okay, first off, you got to realize that CPUs are just emulators now. Like, we haven't been running x86 for about a decade. There's a whole nother operating system running underneath your operating system that's turning x86 into some proprietary thing. That's how these processors work nowadays. So given that you're running in a virtualized environment, you basically have attacks against the virtualized environment, like that's running inside the chip itself. And all that stuff's been optimized for speed, not for security. And so that's why I don't care how neat your modeled sandbox are. The hardware itself is just not designed to deliver what you're looking for. Why I'm interested in ASM.js and that entire family is because you're emitting code to a simpler processor that then, once it's passed through, is apparently still optimizable. So you end up with a state that is actually compilable but not exploitable, at least in theory. You never get raw instructions to the environment that I don't think is securable. That's the point I'm trying to make. Next question.
I just want to make an observation. You were mentioning about detection has been more effective than prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And this just makes me think that, once again, in our engineering, we're coming back to natural systems. Because what does our body do? Our body doesn't try to prevent all pathogens from coming in.
Mm-hmm.
There's no firewall model here. It tries to detect them and then neutralize them. So just an observation that I think we're constantly learning over and over to try to emulate natural systems.
So the natural system analogy is great. I have this entire side project involving curing colorblindness. Spent 6 months on a bioinformatics kick. The natural systems analogies are interesting because some of them are helpful and some of them are incredibly wrong. You, my friend, are a topological donut. you have a tube going through you, which filters out a very small number of particles that it actually allows to make it through into the bloodstream. I would actually argue that is very much a firewall. There is the unclean side and the clean side and systems that try to deal with the relationships between the two. It's important to realize the human body deals with infection in a way that would make most of us uncomfortable. It just goes ahead and kills a bunch of stuff. Hopefully more of the other guys than us. Now, I would love a security model that said, oh, you know, we're infected, let's go fire Japan. Because that's how the human body works. Human body also doesn't patch itself nearly as much. Now, it's becoming clear the genome is not stable, you know, we slowly mutate over time, all those kind of things. But the amount of change that happens to the human body over its life is way less than the amount of change that happens in any organization. You know, we're not growing new fingers every day. Organizations are growing new departments all the time. And so the sort of self-recognition is actually really hard in systems. That being said, the human body is doing some incredibly interesting stuff, and I think there's a lot to learn from it. I just caution against overgeneralization. Do we have a last question here? If there's any more questions, looks like we have time.
I came halfway through, so forgive me if you mentioned this already, but what's your thoughts about Bitcoin, digital currencies, and anonymous payment systems?
Oh, Bitcoin. Oh, my God. No. I spent 4 months trying to break Bitcoin in 2011 and failed and thought that was really interesting. I think I'm the only person to ever get pressed for not hacking something. Bitcoin's really interesting because it should have died instantaneously, okay? Look, it's listening on the network, on its own custom little protocol, it's written in C++, and if you hack it, there's no indirection to getting money, you just get all the money in the world. This should have been like death on a stick. And in fact, everything that I look at, I find like, 15 things that should be wrong. And every time I go through the code, I find the exact place where the bug should be, and it's fixed. So some really good security people have gone through Bitcoin. It is a collection of really interesting properties. It has a bunch of externalities, most of them focused on how you translate between Bitcoin and other currencies that are undefined. And all these undefined places are really where Bitcoin's getting hit, where people are getting robbed. I have no actual position on Bitcoin, except I'm so surprised it still exists. And if people are going to use it, I don't want them to get hacked. My one prediction that is actually fairly positive about Bitcoin is that we have a lot of trouble figuring out how to store any amount of information safely, let alone interface it to the outside world for authentication purposes. I am watching more interesting investment on how to have a Bitcoin wallet that securely interfaces and still allows you to pay money than I've ever seen, even in the authentication and password space. So that's what has me most excited about Bitcoin in 2014. Like, whether or not the system works, it is certainly driving a lot of interesting hardware. And I'm talking about hardware that violates the thing about, hardware people don't know security. A few actually do. Go ahead.
Just a comment about the Capsicum stuff. I work with some of those guys, and they're actually building their own hardware using an FPGA to get around the hardware is not designed for security problems.
And that's a different story.
Yes. So that's where it'll be more interesting. They have a working demo, touchscreen thing that you can actually play with. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun.
Totally different story. If they're running the actual hardware, then they're not those hardware guys. They're not optimizing for speed. They are getting the hardware semantics that they're looking for. The sort of optimizations that get you in trouble are not going to exist there. The only question is if the ARM core they're getting is fast enough, and maybe it is.
I think they're doing MIPS at the moment, but I'm not sure.
All right.
It's been a while.
I have a completely different reaction to that than the other thing.
Right.
So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, totally understandable, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, is to make people aware that that kind of stuff is happening. And it's kind of interesting because it's all being done in Cambridge in the UK, right? And they're getting a lot of government sponsorship from the US.
So there is one thing I want to say, which is that the biggest lie about your computer is that it's just one computer, and that however arbitrarily good or interesting Capsicum is, it doesn't matter if there's 10 other components that have malicious persistence and arbitrary execution streams. So this is not a problem that is solved by making yet another CPU. The entire system I don't actually believe that multi-tenancy is feasible. If you want two computing environments, use two computers. It's okay. They're cheap now. That's my general approach here. But, having not seen this and knowing the biases, I think it's now one of the most interesting things I've heard out for 2014.
Cool. Thank you.
Hello. Very interesting talk. You seem to really like honeypots for a high signal-to-noise ratio probe to basically change it into a game to cheat the bad guy. A lot of honeypots are no longer maintained. What is your current recommendation for deploying, a set of honeypots that doesn't require a full-time, Pooh Bear to watch over them?
I would say basically make a honeypot that looks roughly exactly like a staging environment that no one actually stages against. So we may not know, we may not want to have direct maintenance of stuff, but if your arc, if your environment does not know how to do staging, you've got bigger problems. So I'd say do staging twice. Go ahead.
Oh, back to the Windows thing. Mr. Farrow again.
Bring it on!
Okay, here we go. So I have a friend at Google, and what he does is he runs honeypots for his living. You know, of course, he just makes...
Can he help that guy?
No, because Google really has some resources that they are willing to put in it. And, you know, they actually, they are the masters of automation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've heard of what Niels Provost and what he does.
Yeah.
So when I get to see Niels and I get him to a point where he's willing to talk, some scotch later, I say, okay, Niels, so tell me about what you're starting to find. And the two most interesting things I heard last time, now this is 6 months out of date, is that they have found zero exploits for iPhones and iOS,
mm-hmm.
but what they continue, and XP is just a cesspool, you know, IE6 is something you never want to run because every exploit runs against that. You know, 7, 8, 9, things are much better, but mm-hmm. we still have lots of working exploit for Windows, much fewer for Macs. And back in the days, back in the 90s, right, where there were 10% of your desktops were Macs, 90% were Windows, 10% of your virus were Macs, and 90% were Windows. We don't see that today. So what is your thoughts on why Windows is such a popular hotbed for actually weaponized exploits?
Well, you know, it just worked so well for so long, and it still works enough. I think it is not surprising to me that we don't see much going on in the iOS space. Your opportunities to get code installation on iOS are just simply a lot smaller. I know you didn't bring up Android, and neither did Niels.
Android's not a good model.
No, not working.
But you know the funny thing? The root password for an iPhone is still Alpine after 7 years.
Yes, but when do you get the opportunity to use this knowledge?
Yeah, right, only after so the root of the phone.
Yeah, you know, if I had root, I could totally get root.
Exactly.
So that's, you know, again, you know, it has a root password, it's a single user device, and it knows it.
Mm-hmm.
And look what it's been able to do with that knowledge.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly good, hard to exploit model.
There's a lot of inertia in exploitation. There's also been a lot of, you know, you find the things that you're looking for. It's the whole analogy with you're under the lamp, so that's where you're looking for your keys because that's where you can see.
Mm-hmm.
Any system that is only seeing infections on IE6 on Windows is blind.
Oh, no. I'm just pointing out that that's the weakest of them all, that things, you know, the later versions of Windows are incredibly better. I listen to Mark Murphy talk about that all the time. But on the other hand, I say, well, Mark, why is the exploit scene not changing? Sure, it's harder to weaponize, but that doesn't keep it from happening.
You know, we're not seeing, they just took down 500,000 botnet with zero access.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the botnets have gone away.
Yeah.
They've gotten less disruptive. So there was a really interesting thing with zero access, which is that they were doing Bitcoin mining.
Yeah.
They were making $2,000 a day. You know, that's good money. They stopped because it was disruptive. And it was reducing the population, and they were making so much money from ad fraud that why risk it with this stupid little Bitcoin thing? So a lot of what's gone on is moved to calmer, less disruptive vectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so the machines are still compromised. There's still tremendous numbers of them, but they interfere with the users less. And so that's right. A big thing that's going on.
That's certainly true.
And thanks. I do believe we are out of time.
Yep. Thanks very much.